Today is Tuesday, May 9th, 2017. The time is 11 a.m. This is a hearing of the District of Columbia Rental Housing Commission. The location is the hearing room in Suite 1140 BN, 441 4th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. We are here pursuant to Law 610, the Rental Housing Act of 1985, as amended. I am Commissioner Michael Spencer, and I will serve today to chair this hearing. With me today is Commissioner Diana Hurst-Epps. Chairman Peter Segedie-Mazak has recused himself from any participation in this matter because of an apparent conflict. We have an appeal this morning in regards to the housing accommodations located at 2300 Good Hope Road Southeast, Unit 901. The case number is RHTP 1130151. The appeal is styled Tonica Washington Tenant Appellant versus ANA Marbury LLC, UIP Property Management Housing Provider Appellee. Will both parties please stand? Thank you. The commissioner notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the tenant appellant.
Tanika Washington, present.
And for the housing provider, appellee?
I'm Deborah Legge. I'm counsel for the housing provider.
Thank you. You can be seated. Thanks. I would briefly like to explain commission procedures. The commission's rules are largely similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present its case, beginning with the tenant appellant. The tenant appellant may reserve up to 5 minutes of her 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the case of the housing provider appellee. The housing provider appellee must present all of its arguments within the 20 minutes time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In its discretion, the commission may allow additional time for argument to a party in the event that we engage in questions to occupy a substantial portion of its time. The commission's hearing will be recorded on an audio CD. The commission's decision will be issued in writing and sent to the parties in the next 30 to 45 days. In this proceeding, the commission does not request nor will it accept post-hearing submissions from either party. Please turn off any cell phones or other electronic equipment. The commission would like to ask the parties whether they believe the settlement negotiations will be an option to settle this case before the appeal is heard.
Good morning, Mr. Commissioner and Madam Commissioner. The parties have engaged in multiple settlement discussions to date and currently do not believe that additional mediation would be fruitful, okay. At least speaking for our tenant.
And speaking for the housing provider, that we would agree.
Okay. Can we take a quick second, too, and have the counsel for housing provider, for the tenant to introduce yourselves as well?
Yes, Mr. Commissioner. My name is Mark Forbay. I represent Ms. Washington.
And Andrew Kirtley, and I also represent Ms. Washington.
Thank you. The commission is now not aware of any preliminary matters in this case. The tenant, yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. There are two notes that we would like to make for the record as a housekeeping matter. One is that the parties are agreeing that there is a clerical error in the list of exhibits, so there should be an Exhibit 140 listed, and we believe it's in the record. And we just wanted to note that both sides agree on that. And the second, Mr. Commissioner, is that tenant is not pursuing Appeal Issue 4 regarding appealing the denial of adding a new housing provider, a new owner that was added. And the reason for that is that new owner, in a separate matter, has agreed to be bound by the decision in this matter.
Thank you. I do believe the clerk, we've confirmed the 140 is a part of the actual exhibits, so it's not. Thank you for bringing those up, too. Okay. The tenant appellant may proceed with your case, but first, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Mr. Commissioner, we would like to reserve 5 minutes at the end of our time.
5 minutes is noted. The tenant appellant may proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. Ms. Washington signed a settlement agreement with the housing provider in May of 2011, that's PX 123, where the settlement agreement provides very clearly, parties agree that the rent for unit 901 is $565, effective June 1, 2011. Agree that the rent is $565, effective June 1, 2011, and then there's an additional provision that speaks to how will the rent be increased. Her understanding it was that the rent would be increased per DC rent control law at the time. And in fact, Judge Mangan, in her first order before remand, agreed with that interpretation. So she wrote as a finding that's what it meant, that the rent was $565 and it would increase by CPI plus 2% starting with November. So in September of 2011, a few months later, Ms. Washington received a notice of increase in rent charged from the housing provider that informed her that her rent was going to be going up from $620 to $646, effective November 1, 2011. And Ms. Washington said, that's not my rent. My rent was not $620. It had gone down to $565 per the settlement agreement. So my rent is $565, and it can go up. The percentage that you all are saying it can go up, but $565 then should go up to $589. And she filed this tenant petition in large part to say that's not my rent. There's an error. There's errors going on. No. She was communicating with the housing provider at this time about her rent level, and the housing provider was telling her that, yeah, we're telling the district that your rent is $620 and it's going up to $646, but that's not really what you have to pay. We're gonna. You only have to pay us what you agreed, $565. So that's essentially what they told her, and they told her that fairly repeatedly. But she said, no, I'm not going to be part of that. I want the rent that's filed with the district to reflect my actual rent. The notice on the rent charge says, if you disagree with this, file a tenant petition, and so she did. Her tenant petition said, to date, my rent amount remains incorrect even after contacting management several times via emails to have the amount adjusted to that written in the settlement agreement. So the housing provider was telling her that what they were doing was charging her, they called it rent, the higher amount, so this $620, they called it rent, but then they said that we're gonna give you a concession, we're gonna give you money back. And so, in effect, the amount that she had to pay was a lower amount. And so how does this harm her? It harms her in three ways, at least, and it harms other tenants even more. But it harms her in that when there's these two rent level amounts, which we believe are illegal, and we're here to ask the commission to define that the Rental Housing Act of 1985 no longer permits two rent levels. It's just one. We have a rent charged. And we can talk about what that means, but we think it means the rent that is charged, the rent that she has to pay. So the problem for her is a fewfold. One is that there's accounting craziness, and if you look at the ledgers in this record, PX 138 is a pretty accurate reflection of what the housing provider was telling her was the rent that they were, what was going on rent-wise. There was wackiness, and so one of the wackiness was if you look at November 1, 2011. What was on that ledger for that very first month with this new rent, it said she was going to be charged a rent of $640, and then she was going to get a concession of $81, and then another concession of $55. So how much did she have to pay? A fairly low amount. And so what's going on here? What's going on? And so it was 5 months later that it turned out that the housing provider said, we changed our mind, or we made a mistake. The concession, we're going to take back the $55 concession. We're going to leave the $81 concession. with the effect then that you were paying 560, we were only kind of requiring you to pay 565 all along, and that's weird because the settlement agreement, she thought she was going to have to pay more, 589. All right, so now it's 565. Does that mean in 2 months they can raise it to 589? What's going on? So she wants the protections of rent control. She wants it to be controlled and simple, and she files this and says no, this is not right. You'll also see on the ledger that the landlord, when they were calculating her late fees, so she canceled her check for November and she stopped paying rent. She said, I'm fighting this. So the landlord started assessing late fees and assessed late fees. Late fees, she testified at the hearing, were 5% of her rent. All right, so is it 5% of her rent or 5% of the number that the housing provider is telling the district that is her rent? And so the housing provider said, we're assessing 5% off of the stated rent charge, the higher amount. So late fees are higher than they should be. And then the second financial way that this affects her is that every year then, when you start getting to, how did the housing provider figure out how much to increase her rent every year? So in 2012, for instance, the first time when the housing provider actually told her, we are increasing the amount you have to pay, they increased her rent $36. And that $36 was 5.6% of the way they got to the $36 was they said we're taking the $646 that it had been at the time, we're gonna raise it as much as we can, that higher number, $646 to $682. That's a $36 increase, and so we're gonna shift that $36 increase to Tony's lower amount, to Miss Washington's lower amount. And so going from 565, knocking it up to 682. And of course on our ledger, it said 682, but we're going to take off 81, leaving 601. And so that effective increase, the $36 increase then, was on her rent charge. The amount she was charged was a 6.4% increase, whereas the legal amount was 5.6% at that time. So and that's going to be happening more and more as time goes on, is that the when the landlord is taking the increases off a higher amount, and then just somehow shifting it onto her without any basis in law, that's then going to mean that she's paying more rent every year as time goes on. This has caused confusion, to say the least. So I already mentioned that the judge, the first time that she looked at this settlement agreement and what was supposed to be going on, she wrote in her original final order before remand, finding of fact 2, the agreement provided that the rent on June 1 was $565 per month and could be increased annually beginning November up to the consumer price index plus 2%. And that was her understanding. That was Ms. Washington's understanding, that the settlement agreement said, here's the rent and here's how much it can go up. There were two lawyers who were confused, and with all due respect, these are lawyers I actually respect greatly. One of them is my colleague at the other side, right now, Ms. Levy. She wrote a letter, PX129, to Ms. Washington. It's dated January 2011, but Ms. Levy confirmed at the hearing that was a typographical error. It should be January 2012. And in that letter, she actually said that she looked at that first. This was after Ms. Washington filed her increase, and she said that we actually made a mistake, that we increased your rent $26. This was the first year, so that was 4.2% increase the first year, but it should only have gone up $24 because we inaccurately, in error, we, housing provider, took the increase based on the higher amount and the settlement agreement required rather than the settlement agreement amount. And so she said, sorry, and here's an updated ledger, and her updated ledger then said that your actual rent payment is $589. So this was a little mini ledger that council provided. That never ended up happening.
Council, aren't many of the arguments that you're going to make and you're going to make essentially have to deal with what we're left with is some questions arising out of the actual settlement agreement? And how are we supposed to be able to properly address the issues you're raising when they really squarely, to some extent, begin and end with potential confusion in the wording of a document that was then entered into between the parties that I don't believe we have the ability to go in and pierce in any way.
Thank you. So 2 points on that. One is that we believe that the evidence that this document cannot be interpreted to mean that the only interpretation that really makes sense is here's it's Judge Mangan's first interpretation. Here's the rent amount, and here's the increase. It's going to be basically like rent control, and so that's one argument. The second is that if the commission finds that the agreement was ambiguous, then in our view, we're not actually pointing to the settlement agreement. We're just saying her rent was $565. That's clear in the settlement agreement. The housing provider is the one that's coming and saying, oh, but the settlement agreement said we can do it this way. So they have the burden of arguing what the settlement agreement says. And at the hearing on remand, first of all, the housing provider did not testify. So the only evidence of extrinsic what the parties thought was really Ms. Washington's evidence about that there was no discussion about rent concessions and that it was just straight rent and increase. Second argument, Madam Commissioner, is that we believe that a tenant actually, it doesn't even matter what it says in the settlement agreement, because this is rent control law. And just like in a lease, if a tenant says, I'm going to pay $3,000 a year, but then realizes that that's in violation of rent control, doesn't matter what she agreed in the lease. Here, this is not just about her. This is about the future tenants in that unit. It's about her neighbors. And so for public policy reasons, we argue that she could not, in that document, have agreed to the scheme that the housing provider says it was doing, where there was one rent level that she was charged and another rent level that was being reported to the city. So for public policy reasons, we actually think it really doesn't matter what that provision B meant. If it meant what the landlord maybe was arguing that it meant, I don't even know that the landlord was arguing it was what Judge Mangan found, then it's unenforceable because that's in violation of rent control. So that's our thought as to how this commission can reach our conclusion, which is that whatever was going on, by law, the black and white letter law, a black letter law in the district says that the housing provider has to tell the district and has to tell the tenant the rent charged. And rent charged means the rent that you're charging, which means the amount that you have to pay. The council, effective about a month ago, went in and actually defined the term rent charged. And now there's that definition that did not apply at the time, but it's worth noting. We think this is so common sense. What else can rent charged mean? But now it says, this is a DC code 42-3501.03-29A, rent charged means the amount of monthly rent charged to a tenant by a housing provider for a rental unit covered by the rent stabilization program. It means the amount of monthly rent charged. What else could it mean? So just to answer your question, we think that the statute requires the housing provider to inform the tenant and the district what is the rent charge. One number, not two numbers. And so as a result, it's clear that her rent charge at that time was $565. And then if your rent is $565, then the most that it can increase then was 4.2% off of that $565. And nothing more complicated than that. We just think rent was $565. If the agreement provided for higher than that somehow, then $589, invalid. A tenant cannot waive their rent control protections is our second view. First view is that she didn't. She absolutely did not and waive it. Nothing in this document suggests that she did. The judge pointed to one capitalization, one undefined term that says market, called market rent, and we say that the only way to understand that is as a reference to the previous paragraph there, that it's the rent, that there is no, what does that mean, market rent? Certainly doesn't say that it's the rent that was charged previously or the rent that we're reporting to the district.
My apologies. I've taken about 5 minutes of your time.
No, these are points I wanted to make. Thank you. So the law says specifically a notice of an adjustment to Ms. Washington under the general increase of general applicabilities shall contain a statement of the current rent and the increased rent. The judge found that her current rent was this lower amount, and she... there's no dispute that the amount that she was told were these higher amounts, these incorrect amounts. And so in our view, that's a violation of the law of requiring her to be informed your current rent charge is this, your new rent charge is that, the increase is this, it's effective at this date. So that was a violation. And then there's a second provision that says any, in terms of filing with RAD, that those filings, if they're done, for instance, in bulk, as they were here, they have to state the unit number, tenant name, previous rent charged, new rent charged, and effective date for each rent increase. And so that's at DC code 42-3502.05G1. And here, the housing provider filed notices that said that her rent was $620 and was going up to $646, that her rent charge were these amounts. And they actually swore under penalty of perjury or affirmed under penalty of perjury that these facts were correct. And so we think that was a violation of rent control law.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
The tenant also raised on appeal that the ALJ failed to address numerous other reductions in services besides the infestation. We know in the first order, the ALJ addressed infestation, the AC, as well as security. After remand, she added more analysis to the infestation issue. What other services, specific services, did the tenant argue were reduced, or do you just take issue with the way those three issues were decided below?
The commission, in its first decision, indicated in fairly strong language that that Judge Mangan, in her first order, essentially, we see that as a violation of due process, that what's required of her is to say what facts she's finding, explain how she got there, apply the law to those facts, and to do that in a way that informs the tenant about how did you get where you got. It's not just pulling something out of a box. And so I would say to your question, it's really the second. We're not saying that there are numerous issues that she has not addressed at all. I would say that in her final order on remand, she really only did address the bugs, but so our contention is that there was not enough detail there for Ms. Washington to be really able to challenge the finding, what findings she made and how she got there, and so that's our concern with the issues about housing code violations.
Okay.
And on that point, Mr. Commissioner, we are asking, because this is really this would be the fourth time. There was the first order that went up to the commission, then it went back down, and then we filed a motion for reconsideration saying, please do what the commission said, and then with all due respect to Judge Mangan, so there were really three times, and so we're asking the commission that if it deems that this needs to go back down on remand, to send it to a different ALJ, which is within the commission's rules to do for good cause.
All right, you have a few minutes left.
Thank you.
Your time.
I would refer the commission to a committee report, and there were really two committee reports, and this is to legislation that was passed in 2006, passed and took effect in 2006, that talked about why the council was the council's view on its dual system that it had previously, this rent ceiling system and a rent charge system. And our contention is that what the housing provider here was doing was illegally getting back to that system. And what the committee report said that, among other things, it says that Rental Housing Act at that time has many concepts and computations that are so convoluted that it's difficult for tenants to understand. Thus, while most tenants understand the concept of rent charge, that is, the rent each must pay every month to live in their apartments, very few tenants understand the concept of rent ceilings, much less the variety of ways rent ceilings may be increased or decreased. These changes are often based on an apartment's rental history. And then it talks about part of this bill was about requiring disclosure of the history. And so we've only touched a little bit about how this affects other people, and from my perspective, that's the heart of this, is that when there are these, when the housing provider is allowed to tell the RAD that the amount of rent that they're charging, Ms. Washington, is higher than the amount of rent they're really charging, the main victim on this is the next tenant. So the next tenant comes in, has no clue what Ms. Washington was actually, the actual rent charge, the truthful rent charge. They've got just this filing. And so the landlord can then keep taking rent increases off this higher, artificial, incorrect amount. And of course, vacancy increases are also taken off of the filed amount, presumably here. I mean, we don't know, but the whole purpose, and I think it's kind of clear, and Judge Mangan said that the landlord was trying to, quote-unquote, preserve increases and preserve its ability to charge more later, and our view is that that's no longer permitted. Council said we want a simple system, get rid of this confusion, best for everybody, and just have rent charge, and the landlord has to report it, has to take increases off of that. And I'm happy to come back later for more.
Okay, thank you. Are you ready?
Thank you, commissioners. The housing provider's take on this is obviously much different than the tenants. Our position remains that there was a settlement agreement that was reached between the tenant and the landlord. In that agreement, there's some ambiguity that asked to what was and was not negotiated, although the tenant argues that she did not agree to certain language, there's nothing in the settlement agreement that says that the landlord agreed to notify RAD that they would be reducing the rent. There's nothing in the settlement agreement that says even that they were reducing the rent. Instead, it says that the tenant's responsible for paying $565. And then there's this concept of market rent. Both sides were represented by counsel in this case. Tenant argued that because evidence was presented at the hearing on remand about what her interpretation is, that should hold weight. Well, the reality is there was a hearing before the administrative law judge. At that hearing before the administrative law judge, she interpreted what the settlement agreement was, and that interpretation is entitled to deference before the commissioner as the finder of fact. And the interpretation by Judge Mangan is that there was a concession, that the landlord was entitled to have a concession of this difference in the amount. Rather than go back and forth as to the exact numbers, I think that the record is it's more of an academic question than the exact numbering. And the question becomes, is a landlord entitled to have a concession? The tenant obviously argues that they're not, but there's nothing in the Rental Housing Act that says that a landlord is prohibited from that. And the Court of Appeals and HH Housing would argue that a landlord can negotiate to have a concession. And there's been other cases regarding voluntary agreements where there have been decisions that there certainly can be this two rent levels that a tenant...
So I'm going to stop you there. You said that the parties or the landlord can negotiate to have these relationships.
Correct.
Okay, which seems fair. Does, in this instance, how are you able to discern when the document appears to be silent whether that actually occurred?
Well,
or is it a one-sided thing in the housing provider's mind? They had their own negotiation, and so we're to assume there was, essentially a meeting of the minds over this interpretation of viable negotiation.
Well, the bigger question is when there's ambiguity, who wins? There's nothing in the agreement that says that you can't do this. There's nothing in the agreement that says that the landlord had to reduce the rent on record with the city. Ms. Washington did not negotiate that term into the agreement. Her attorneys did not negotiate a term into the agreement that the housing provider would be notifying the city of a lower rent either. So there's may not be an ambiguity here, but it was on both sides that there was an failure to negotiate either way, that either there's a concession terminology or that there's a terminology that the landlord...
So in the instance, since we're here in the Rental Housing Commission, under the purview of the rental, the act, and understanding the policy decisions in development of the act, when you're at an impasse, when there is evidently ambiguities with regard to these types of issues, would it be appropriate to look to the policy of why we're even here in trying to decide how best to go forward?
Well, the policy here was there was a negotiation between the two parties to settle a case. The parties did settle the case. Ms. Washington was to pay a lower rent. Ms. Washington got that. She's not paying the higher rent that she's asking for, or that we are discussing. As far as other policies regarding protecting low-income housing or anything else, those aren't at issue here, because we're not talking about anyone other than Tonika Washington. Future tenants are not at issue here because they are not parties to this case. This is a case about Tonika Washington. It is not a case about any other individual. This is a case regarding a settlement agreement and and the contractual interpretation of it. And the administrative law judge interpreted it.
Can I ask you a quick question? This is to your, just for reference, it's your brief in opposition on page 7.
Forgive me, just let me find that right page.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it starts with the definition of rent in D.C. Code, section 42, 3501, 0328 does not exist in a vacuum, as the tenant seems to suggest. The footnote then goes on, footnote 7, says rent is defined as the entire, rent is defined as, quote, the entire amount of money, money's worth, benefit, bonus, or gratuity demanded, received, or charged by a housing provider as a condition of occupancy or use of a rental unit, its related services, and its related facilities, unquote. Then the next paragraph goes on to say, in the second sentence, the evidence clearly showed that the tenant knew the higher amount was not demanded of her. Can you help me reconcile the definition of rent with that statement that it wasn't demanded?
Well, the difference here is there was Ms. Washington testified during the evidentiary hearing as to what she was to pay for her rent. She testified, forgive me, I think it was footnote 5 in my brief. I don't know, and I know it was identified in the judge's order as to the timing of it.
It was footnote 5.
That as to what her rent was those owed. So although there was these notices, or the notice of rent increase that were sent out, she clearly was on notice that her, or that she was not to pay that amount. She's testifying, and that's a that is an admission by Ms. Washington that she was not paying that amount, and she knew she was not to pay that higher amount. And when you are, and our position remains that when you're talking about this, that she knew that as part of her, this definition of rent, to make it easier instead of the actual numbers, if you received this notice of rent increase and it was $5,000, but you knew that you only had to pay $200 of it. And you knew that every single month, that, and the landlord, and there was more paperwork to present that evidence. If a landlord came in and tried to present evidence and tried to sue for non-payment of rent based on that $5,000, how would a landlord proceed on that? How would a landlord...
Respectfully, I see where you're trying to go. I'm still stuck on trying to reconcile the definition of rent that you have cited here in footnote 7 with the second sentence in paragraph 2 on page 7.
Well, there's many, for instance, there's many instances in this city, or, well, there's some instances in the city where tenants have negotiated a lease that includes as a specific language in there that they're entitled to for a short period of time a reduction in their rent. And in that case, specifically, the rent would be that $5,000, but they're only obligated, or they're entitled to this specific concession of $4,800 in my instance. And so they're in that definition of rent, it's the entire amount of money.
That's demanded, right?
That's demanded. They know in that instance that contractually the landlord is only entitled to receive $200 because of the other terms and the other agreements. So there may be a demand, or there may be a document that says $5,000, but there's other documentation also says but the landlord can't collect that. They have to also abide by the other contractual terms, the other agreements that say that we can't collect that $5,000. Instead, the landlord has to also provide this, in that instance, the $4,800 concession to that tenant.
In this case, how would you describe this alleged concession? Would you consider it to be perpetual?
Yes.
Okay, and with that, can you distinguish between a fixed sum and a fixed duration settlement for this concession?
If in my instance where, let's say it was for the term of a lease, mm-hmm. a one-year lease, could you please explain it more?
Yeah, you argue that we have a perpetual concession in this situation. And in your earlier example, you said, you know, if there's a short period of time and we agree that $5,000 isn't to be paid or whatever amount you cited. I'm just trying to understand, if there's a fixed sum for this concession, or is it just a fixed duration of, as long as Ms. Washington lives in this unit, she's guaranteed to have X amount of dollars, however that translates off of her rent.
In this case, Ms. Washington, because of the terms of this agreement, the landlord is obligated to continue to give her a concession. This property has been transferred, and actually I think it's been transferred more than once since this case was originally filed, and the subsequent landlords are also bound by the terms of this agreement to continue to give Ms. Washington a concession so that she, although there may be someone new that has to step into the shoes, she's not harmed by the fact that there was a sale of the building. In the terms of a fixed concession, if it was a one-year concession and at the end of that specific term, it's expired, and the landlord would be entitled to charge a higher amount. But that's not what we're saying. We're saying that for the remainder of Ms. Washington's tenancy in Unit 901, the landlord is obligated, whomever the landlord remains in there, to provide a concession and to only increase her rent based on the CPI from that amount. They cannot increase our... cannot say, I'm a new landlord, and therefore I don't have to.
I have more questions, but I know we've taken a ton of your time up. So
I've already stated all of my arguments in my brief, perfect. So I'm happy to answer every single
perfect.
Question you
Thank
have.
You. So Ms. Washington's counsel explained what their perceived definition of market rent is. Can you explain the housing provider's view as far as the settlement agreement?
The housing provider's view is that had we been able to rewrite this, there would have been two terms, and that's the problem, is if I could rewrite this. But that the market are, in other cases, that I unfortunately am going to have to say it, in other cases what would be occurring, because I can't define it in anything but what the terminology is in here. But for Ms. Washington, what should be occurring, or what's to occur, is... So when we started, each year at 565, Ms. Washington, or the landlord was agreeing that Ms. Washington was only to, as of June 1, 2011, Ms. Washington was to pay $565. As of the next rent increase, which I believe was November 1, 2011, her increase was to be effective off of that $565 because so it would be the CPI plus 2 at the maximum. The landlord then was entitled to also setting to the side. So I'm going to explain this two parts. Mm-hmm. So each year the landlord could increase Ms. Washington as the market, so Ms. Washington's rent, first of all, the most important portion for Ms. Washington, should be increased each year what she's obligated to pay for $565. CPI plus 2 each time the rent was increased. Then the market rent is what the rent was prior to the settlement negotiations. They would each November, if they continue to increase as of November 1, if the landlord did not give an increase to Ms. Washington one year, they should not be taking an increase also. They would then be increasing that market rent, that higher level, at the exact same time. So the CPI plus two. So if, for easier numbers, because I get confused when I look at these, if you said $500 for Miss Washington's, you'd do CPI plus two, mm-hmm. and $1,000 CPI plus two off of that each time for each year. And then the concession would be the difference between the two.
And as for the late fees?
Like, the late fees should be off of the Miss Washington's rent. And if there were late fees off of the higher, that should be corrected. And that would be correct. There is a pending landlord and tenant case, and that would be ultimately corrected in the landlord and tenant case. Okay.
So I guess I just kind of have to ask, because based on what you just stated, in a perfect world, there'd be two definitions, and obviously that's not what we have here, but what would be the need for the extra paragraph? What would that help? How would that help?
Well, having the extra language in there?
Yes.
Well, it would provide the clarity that would have hopefully avoided this tenant petition, so that would have helped a great deal in avoiding litigation time and frustration for the parties. So that would have been helpful in that instance.
That's assuming that that additional paragraph of clarity would actually have been an agreement such that there was a meeting of the minds. Is that correct?
There may have also been, and that implies a lot of things, yes. That also could have meant that there was no settlement agreement and the parties would have had a tenant petition hearing. We can't talk about what did or did not happen during the settlement negotiations during this case.
So is there any necessity for, I guess when I was looking at this, the idea that initially I'm gathering that when the initial concession took place, the very, very initial one, it caused some initial confusion as to creative accounting. I mean, how did that work out? Because it appears that obviously there was some confusion when it initially happened, that there was an increase and then it was kind of a eureka moment that it actually was a concession. Is that when there initially there was initial realization of the...
I'm going to have to defer an explanation of what Ms. Washington thought and what Ms. Washington understood to her, because I can't explain what she thought. I know that PX 140 that was previously discussed gives some explanation as to what Ms. Washington was thinking. But
the only reason I raise it is, I guess initially there's been a few kind of hiccups in the accounting practices. The wrong adjustments were applied, and so I'm not sure if there was some actual confusion on the housing provider side as to how their responsibilities with rent increases were supposed to go, or those were just basic clarifiers.
I think it's the fact that this is a very, very large housing accommodation. There's two towers and several other buildings, and unfortunately things like this happen, and sometimes unfortunately mistakes do happen with math. So there was a time that, as Mr. Borbay had indicated, there were actually two concessions being applied, which was reducing the rent below what had been negotiated, and then later the landlord said that was our mistake and you shouldn't be entitled to two concessions because that was going even below the $565, as I understand the exact numbers. But that doesn't mean the fact that there were some clerical errors that means that the settlement agreement does not permit this. It does not mean that under rent control it's not permitted. It just means that there was clearly some errors, or there were some issues in executing. And there's also the difficulty that if landlords aren't, or the tenant discuss public policy arguments, there's also the reality that if landlords, on the alternative side for public policy arguments, if landlords have to settle a tenant petition, agree to a lower rent just to get a settlement agreement resolved, that does not mean that they're admitting that the settlement agreement are, is an omission of liability or anything else, but it's maybe an omission, in certain instances, an omission of cost perspectives, that they should be for all eternity losing that rent increase that they had been entitled to. They had, over the a period of time, increased the rent level for that unit. And why should the fact that they chose for a cost savings perspective to avoid further litigation result in them losing that entitlement to that higher rent level if a agreement is reached where the concession language is very clear? I'm using that word for a reason. Because I want to make it clear that as a public policy, I don't think as a public policy argument that the tenant's argument holds any weight, because that our parties should be able to negotiate that. And if parties are not able to negotiate such language, that can really hinder the ability for parties to settle. If a landlord, or sometimes landlords aren't settling for any other reason than the sheer cost of legal fees. And they should be entitled to settle for those reasons. One thing I just want to make sure to note, I would very strongly object to, if this case were to be remanded, that the case be remanded to a different administrative law judge. The landlord, this case was heard by one administrative law judge, and the case should be heard, or a decision should always be rendered by that administrative law judge. When that administrative law judge remains available to issue a decision, they were there to see the demeanor of the parties. So we would strongly object to that. I just want to add that in there. But yeah. I have nothing that I have not already put in the papers that I need to add for argument.
I know counsel for the tenant talked about the old rent ceiling, rent charge dichotomy, and it pretty much the two-track system. Can you talk about just generally your how there's one rent with the, based on this alleged concession, there's one rent reported and paid by the tenant, and there's another rent that's reported to the rent administrator. Like, can you just generally just however you want to enlighten me on the basis for that in this situation?
Are you saying how that's different than rent ceilings?
Yes.
Well, the difference in rent between that and rent ceilings is the rent ceilings were oftentimes...
I'm sorry, and also from a public policy perspective. I know you want to limit this to just Ms. Washington, but just so we could just think about this, how it may impact other tenants as well.
Is there something specific that you're inquiring about as to public policy?
I know earlier you mentioned that this case and your right to do is about Ms. Washington. I know when the counsel for the tenant talked about it, he talked about it in a larger scheme as a district situation. So I just want to have your opinion as far as not just the legalities of it, but just from a public policy standpoint, how are we to comport this distinction from the old system of rent ceilings and rent charge?
Well, there's still a difference because, one, the old ceilings, it could over time, I mean, it was in part the issue of there were tenants who had lived in the building for decades, and so some of them were paying a mere fraction of what other tenants were. Now that still does occur, obviously. But we're not talking here about $1,000 difference. We're talking, I believe, I don't even know if it's a couple $100 difference between this point. Don't want to talk out of turn on the exact amount. But the fact that the rent ceilings versus a concession has been abolished does not mean that a concession is are unacceptable and is not permitted under rent control. The city, as I understood, it was before my time, unfortunately, so that part of the reason that rent ceilings were removed was it was that landlords are, it could surprise tenants that they could all of a sudden, years later, receive this very large rent increase that was based on a vacancy increase or something else. And it could be based on a increase 10 years before. And the housekeeping, the difficulty of maintaining those records is much more difficult than if each and every year the most you can do is a CPI plus 2 unless it's a petition-based increase. The paperwork behind this is a fraction of the paperwork behind both keeping both rent ceilings and rent our rent increases. Because here you have paperwork that's filed with the city that says the rent charges whatever it may be. And then there's paperwork with the tenant themselves or between the landlord and that particular tenant that's saying that that particular tenant is entitled to a concession. But that concession only applies to that particular tenant and does not mean that the next tenant of the unit receives a benefit. But it gives the landlord also the benefit from a public or as the public policy concept of choosing or in other instances choosing to negotiate with tenants when it helps to settle cases or choosing to negotiate with tenants when it comes to entering into leases that they may be able to charge a much higher rent, but it's December 30th, they want to before the end of the year get up to a full vacancy in the building, and so they agree to a much lower rent for that one unit because it would get them full occupancy of the building. So there's reasons like that that a landlord may choose to accept a lower rent from a tenant just from either cash flow purposes or for other reasons that the landlord should be able to contract to accept a lower amount from a particular tenant but not forever lose that right to the higher rent if either the market goes up or if a new tenant comes in and that either the market's gone up or it's just now August and it's you live are inspired by George or Georgetown and so you would be able to command a better price than you would be able to at Christmas.
Anything else?
I have nothing further.
Perfect. Thank you. Rebuttal?
Yes, thank you. A few points. Double H housing did not deal with rent control. So obviously parties in the free market realm can negotiate rents, whatever they want. But within the rent control context, that's not the case. And so yes, there is an appeal to the idea that a landlord and tenant should be able to negotiate how this is all going to work. But rent control is actually kind of says no, that a tenant, doesn't matter what a tenant agrees to, if the tenant agrees to pay more, and our argument that's void and contrary to public policy, and in fact, the tenant gets it all back, so it doesn't matter what they've agreed to. We think it's important that this really does affect other people, so this is not just about the two people, and if you're going to draw the line anywhere, we think it should be that a tenant cannot agree to let a landlord file false documents with the city, and our view is that that's what happens. That kind of a wink, wink. We're going to charge you one thing. We're going to tell the city we're charging something else. That hurts other people, and that shouldn't be within the purview of a landlord and a tenant. I want to address the one thing that the Judge Mangan, she talked about New York law, and she felt that was persuasive. New York law is a completely different system. They've got by statute and regulation, they've got a system called preferential rents, where, yeah, they allow something like this. We think this wouldn't have been allowed there either. But New York law is not district law. So 9 New York City Rules and Regulations 2521.2 talks about preferential rents. When the amount of rent charged to and paid by the tenant is less than the legal regulated rent, that shall be known as a preferential rent, and it talks about how that system works. So yeah, that can happen in New York. In 2006, the city council says, no, we're going to have one rent charged here. And so obviously this is not New York. I would commend to the commissioners to take the committee reports, and there are two, a bit hard to find, frankly, both associated with Bill 16-109, and they talk about some of this history. I would ask that council's interpretation of how this document was supposed to work. That's a better interpretation than Judge Mangan found. She kind of said, doesn't really matter as long as ultimately the tenant doesn't have to pay more than she agreed. So amount of increases doesn't matter. And number two, it's not what the landlord did. And so to the extent that council is kind of conceding that rent increases should be based, the percentages should be based off the lower amount, which I heard her do just now, that requires some reversal and remand, because here rent increase number two was they took it off the higher amount and shifted the dollar figure down, and so we would say that's not what the agreement contemplated. Council appears to have conceded that, and I think in her letter, as we stated, she also had the same interpretation, so her position has not changed. We would like the order to reflect that that's how increases should be based off of this lower amount. This is not just about public policy. It's about plain meaning of the statute. We really feel like if you take a look at the statutes that the landlord is required to report the rent charged. And rent charged has really just one meaning, not two meanings. So we think that's really, really important. With regard to confusion, I didn't mention that it's in the brief, but that Ms. Washington was sued by another attorney who will also respect, the separate counsel, and on that complaint, it listed her rent. What is her rent? The higher amount. So $646. So she was being taken to court, and the allegation in court was the amount that she owed each month was $646. I will say that there's another number, which was how much did she already owe, and that was correct, but the amount that was listed as her rent was the wrong higher amount. Finally, the council has indicated that this would be a permanent concession, and we don't see anything in here that guarantees that when any kind of concession of this sort is transferred to a new owner, or especially if there's a foreclosure, that this would remain. Whereas rent control protections protect you regardless of who the owner is, and so that's a key protection that she would get if she had the filings were proper, and it's kind of a way that this actually matters to her. If there's a foreclosure, she's going to lose, and a bank who had a prior lien on the property came in and said, what, an agreement with this landlord? Why should I be bound by it? There's nothing in rent control law that says she's protected. The only way she'd be protected is if the landlord had filed the proper filings. So for those reasons, we're asking the court to order that the reverse, but order that the correct rent control filings be made with the district, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Any more questions for you?
The commission's hearing is now completed. It is, my site serves me correctly, I think it's 11:58 or 59. We'll go with 59. The commission will attempt to issue the decision in this case to the parties within the next 30 to 45 days. Thank you both, all for being here. We're adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.